Accession number 13359, George Richardson, reel 17.
Mr. G. S. Richardson, Reel 17. There wasn't a great deal of activity, you said, Mr. Richardson. What happened next?
Well, after we'd captured a hauler, we and not a lot of resistance, we went forward. We were watching all the supplies, and we were pleased to see our carriers had come ashore, our carriers all assembled. Our mortars had all come ashore, most of our transport came, and then once we saw our artillery and tanks begin to land, the 7th Armoured Division and Guards Armoured Division, as soon as we saw those coming ashore, we knew that we weren't afraid of further action in front of us. We'd been scared of running inshore because we didn't know what we were going to expect. Who thought we'd, you know, be mown down because we were sitting ducks on a bobbing up and down on the sea, but as it turned out, it was quite a good landing. I know we had some casualties further down the beaches. The battalion took all day to reassemble, and but eventually the whole of the brigade were ashore, and I think our losses were light out of the whole of the brigade.
Had you seen many civilians other than the ones you've mentioned?
Not a lot. There were some, but I think they're all down in the cellars. We did, as we were going through a hauler, there was some Sicilians came out with this Italian, young Italian soldier with his hands up. He'd been sheltering in their house, and they were frightened to hold him, so they tipped him over to us. He was just a young lad, and I was searching for weapons. He didn't have any. He had a beautiful silver hunter watch on the chain, and I thought, well, I'm going to have that. I took it off him, and he started crying and asked him, what's on your watch? What's the matter? You probably took it off one of our lads anyhow. But, of course, I couldn't speak Italian, couldn't speak English. And he's crying and pointing to the back of the watch, so I opened it. And there was a photograph that where I took to be his wife and baby. So I says, oh, it's no good to me here. Handed it back. But probably when he went back into the prison of war, whoever took him from us wouldn't bother to let him keep it.
Was it the usual procedure to take things like this?
It was with us, I'm afraid. We didn't think that it was stealing. We thought they were... the Germans did the same with us. We captured quite a lot of Germans and Italians that had wristwatches, English wristwatches, and English pens, fountain pens, things like that. That they were the things that we took after we disarmed them. Nothing else that were worth taking, really, because, I mean, their money was no good to us. Our money at that time was military currency.
Was there any looting of premises?
Oh, no, not I know of. Not going in and staying. No, I don't think that the British Army did much of that. Certainly not our battalion. Not I heard of, no.
What were your first impressions of Sicily? Again, it was a new area.
Well, was it entirely new? Very mountainous, very hilly, very green, and lots of sea along the side. And we were advancing inland, just a few miles from the sea. The further we advanced, we Didn't see much action for quite a long while.
Had you rejoined your company?
Oh yes. After the first night, I'd been called back to battalion headquarters. My duty with the Royal Marine was finished when we'd got ashore. There was no real need for him to liaison between our battalion and his ships. He would probably go forward as a Royal Marine gunnery officer and probably go forward with our advance, but I never saw after that again. He got his own signalers and his own orders. But I went back to battalion headquarters and we carried on advancing steadily until we came to a town. We were going forward with tanks and all our. We came to a town. Well, I think this was Carntini. We were advancing up this town. We left Corporal Bell, Harry Bell, at a corner because there was a crossroad and we to direct the traffic up. And we were just going along nice and happy and content, nothing much happening in convoy, when all of a sudden this blasted great Italian tank came dashing down the road, firing at everything it could as it was passing. Our truck stopped, we jumped over the nearest wall and it went on, and it must have knocked at least 7 trucks out as it was going down, set them on fire, killed quite a few. When he got down to the bottom of the road, there was a tank just coming round. But just before the tank got to stop him, they killed Harry Bell on the corner. It was a shame about that. He was one of our good corporals that had come survival from Dunkirk and all the desert. And he was just standing on point duty and got killed by a tank that was just out for a VC or whatever they call them in their language. And as soon as they saw the big tank had come round and faced them, they just jumped up and surrendered. They'd done all that damage up there and they were just taken prisoner. I don't even know what happened to them, but I don't. But this is only hearsay because I was further up the line, but we heard that where it happened, and we finished up at the top side of this village. Our troops were ducking up in woodland at the top side of the village, and then we were told to run lines out back to our battalion to stay for the night, and we had to make sure that an event like that didn't happen again, because I think we've been going about it 2 lackadays ago. That's why that had happened, for a tank just to come swanning down the road without any interference. Nobody's firing back at it. Not I at all. I was down behind the wall. In fact, I don't think I'd left my rifle or I probably had a pistol on. But he went down that quick. Took us all by surprise. And
did the terrain have any effect on your ability to communicate with various companies? And
so oh, on? Yes. We were using wireless a lot because we were advancing quite freely going forward. After this quarantine, I'm pretty sure it was Carntini. I know it was down the valley and went up under some high ground from there. Colonel Watson and his driver in his jeep asked our signal officer for a signaler to go with a signal truck, and there was a signal driver, myself, a signaler, him, that's a CEO, his driver, and I think another one, and we're all carrying Tommy guns. And we went up. Why he was doing a recce as a commanding officer, I can't understand. But we went along a lonely valley, a winding valley, very high hills at both sides. Eventually, we finished up on top of a high hill into a little village right at the top. Our battalion were miles and miles behind. And when we got up there, we were stopped outside of a little church and on a square. The locals come out, first British troops had seen. There was no action whatever, nobody trying to kill us. And Sammy Watson was, you know, his colonel's outfit, and he was more or less showing himself around. And they were more or less giving him some worship, telling them that they wanted the Italians, they were Sicilians, and they didn't want anything to do with Mussolini and all the rest of it, you know, and them that could speak a little bit of English. Anyway, Theo turned around to me, he says, all right, Corporal Richardson, send a message back to battalion headquarters and tell them to advance to the point I've already given them, and map references and such. So I thought, well, it must be at least 12 miles away. No way am I going to get a message back. So I put every aerial I had up, sent the message back, and down my back came the answer. Message received, received and we'll carry on. And half an hour after, we saw the blooming battalion moving up the valley. We stood up there and then we moved down to where the position was. But I was amazed, and he just turned around, you know, send his message, and it did. What had happened if I hadn't got the message through, I don't know. I'd probably have been doing what the private straight away, but it happened, and we advanced the battalion. But why he had gone there, and by the way, from there, it was the first sight I had of Mount Etna. We looked over, and we could see this huge mountain in the distance, with its head in clouds, where I thought, this huge pile of stuff over the top of it, and later we found out it was smoke coming from Mount Etna. That was the first sighting of Mount Etna I had. And as a matter of fact, I had to ask, can I excuse myself, well, what's that over there? And I said, oh, that's Mount Etna. And I looked at his map and found out.
You had no opposition at this stage?
Up to then, except for that tank that had come down and caused a disturbance. No, we were advanced for miles and miles and miles inland. There was others advancing along the coast road, and we were advancing inland. I imagine 6 or 7 miles. I've often looked at the map of Sicily since and recognised the places that we've gone through and the track we took. It was just a minor road, but we had the whole battalion advanced along that road, and eventually came out into some plains, more flatter ground, and getting quite closer to Mount Etna, and not far from Catania. And the further we got towards Catania, we knew that we were getting towards more action, because there was a lot of more gunfire going off, more and more tanks to be seen, and Royal Artillery in position. And we eventually just came to be front line troops again. And 2 or 3 miles back from a major river, one of the very few rivers that they have in Sicily, the River Simeto. And that was our next action.
What's the morale like for troops advancing? What are the feelings as you advance?
Well, up to then, we were fairly confident. The Germans were retreating. And it's nothing like putting confidence in troops when you're advancing your ground and the enemy retreating. And that's the main thing that we've been trying to do all the war. We'd been run back all the way from Gazala down. Then we chased them all the way back to Tunisia. And now that we were chasing them back in Sicily, we thought, well, okay, we're on the winning streak again. And I know I felt elated. And we've done quite well. We've done quite well until we're told that we had to make a bridge out across this next river. And we went forward on a little recce up to about a half mile from the river, and then moved back. And then I think it was the 8th Battalion went over to the right side of the bridge on a night time crossing, and lost quite a lot of men. Quite a lot of them were drowned. Quite a lot of them, because they were fully armed, and the river was fairly full at the time. And they were, when they got to the other side, they were running into heavy machine gun fire, and they didn't make a bridgehead.
What was the position like that you were attacking?
Oh, there were vineyards, lemon and lime trees, and bushes, vineyards, bushes about 4 or 5 feet tall, all in the fruit. All the trees, all the orange and lemon trees are all laden with fruit. And unknown to us, as we were crossing that river in the next night, when we did the river crossing on the left side of the bridge, as fast as our troops were going over the river bank, they were being mowed down. There was quite a lot got forward and quite a lot got wounded. Some got, but the Germans were sniping from up in the trees. They could see us and we couldn't see them. This was on the second night. I think we advanced with a good artillery barrage. Our 25 pounders were sending down a good barrage, whereas the 8th Battalion had only gone with a small barrage. We advanced, and the 9th Battalion came alongside the bridge. We were downriver from the bridge. And I remember I was with the CO and our second in command, Major Woods. And the CO, Sammy Watson, he was really cowed down. He didn't put his head over the top. There was men shouting for help over the top, wounded. George Woods, I think it was, I'm not sure, but it was Major Woods, second in command, shouted for stretcher bearers. He got quite a few, and they went over the top, but were still being sniped at. They brought some back and he got wounded himself.
Said that Colonel Watson was obviously under stress.
Well, he was under that much stress. We'd gained the river, but he was trying to go over the top, and we were with him, and until he moved over the top, we had no orders to go over the top, because we went where he went, with his battalion quarters.
Did men around notice the condition he was in?
Yes. Not only men, but officers, especially Major Woods, because I heard Major Woods call him a coward. I was quite close to him. It's a shame to be talking about the man. I know he's dead now, but he'd been a good officer, and he'd done a lot of good service, and he'd gone forward in action in the desert and done quite a lot of action. But he'd gone ashore on Sicily and led our battalion in and all that. But when it come to the crunch, he could see that every time everybody popped their head over, they were just being killed. And it was quite a lot. I understand that our brigade lost 500 men just in that one crossing.
Do you feel, because you were close to him, obviously, and you were very much a part of his communication with the rest of the battalion, do you feel that he was losing control of the battalion?
Yes, he actually had. Mostly because the rest of the officers could see that. The company commanders more or less were taking command of their own companies, and gradually, as the day wore on, more and more troops were coming up and more artillery was bombarding over, and our troops were managing to dig in advance through this orchard, and the Germans were being knocked out of the trees when they found out what was happening, because we made a bridgehead. And gradually our troops went in, but only what, no more than about half a mile from that bridgehead before we dug in and made our ground.
Did this affect the relationship between officers and men and the colonel subsequent to this, afterwards?
Yes. He was sent back. He lost his command. I don't know whether it was officially, but he was sent back to be given a staff job. And Major Woods took over. I think Major Woods took over until another CO came to take over from him. And I'm pretty sure Major Woods got badly wounded in that action when he's trying to rescue a wounded man. The next day, some of our light tanks from the, I think it was the Guards Arm, had gone forward on a recce with some of our carrier platoon, and they'd gone 2 or 3 mile further up. And they found that the Germans were lying in a ditch about a mile back from this river crossing, and they couldn't be seen. It was this ditch that we know nothing about, and as fast as we were getting up to try and advance, there were just more than our lads down, because it was that kind of terrain. You had to more or less creep through the bushes to gain any advance.
What did the situation look like after the battle?
Well, I was sent to Lear Lane. Our battalion headquarters had moved back behind the river. I was sent to with a line party to Lear Lane across the bridge to a 9th battalion who were more or less in that area, and to some of our forward companies that were round to the left. And while we had to fasten the lines up along the top of the bridge so that out of the road of transport. And at the other side of the bridge, there was a 9th battalion corporal with his section digging in right next to a knocked out 88mm artillery gun, German artillery gun. And Montgomery came up with his jeep, and a jeep with the Royal Military Police in. And he stopped beside this corporal while we were just a few 10 yards or so away, so I had to end up. The corporal took no notice of him. So Montgomery bent down, picked about a couple hundred cigarettes up and threw them into the ditch. Corporal bent down and threw them back into the Montgomery's jeep. And Montgomery just turned his jeep round and went back, and the Red Cops picked his corporal up and took him away. And the next week I heard was that he had a good job back in base. Never saw him again, but that, we just heard, that's just his, he hadn't been court-martialed, as far as we knew, because he'd had the strength to stand up and, take cigarettes, that's more or less. He was a Geordian. He was absolutely fed up with Montgomery.
Was this the prevalent feeling throughout the battalion?
It was then, because Montgomery had started calling us his Montgomery's Own. We were becoming to be known as Montgomery's Own, and we didn't want to be Montgomery's Own. What the hell's the matter with the rest of the British Army? I mean, every time we go into action, we're losing some more of our mates. What's the matter with the rest of the British Army? They haven't got a right to go forward. So, at that time, just after a major battle across the river, Bridgehead, then I don't quite understand how the corporal felt. But I wouldn't have dared do it myself. That was a couple then, but I wouldn't have dared pick the cigarettes up and throw them back. I'd have probably just said, hey, I mean, I don't want them, you know. But
did you feel yourself, or did you hear men around you, blaming the hierarchy, the higher command, for putting you into a battle in that situation where you're up against such stiff opposition?
Yes, because I think that river crossing was taken a bit too premature. I don't think they'd done Air Force reconnaissance on the land between that river and the bottom of Catania. I don't think it'd been reconnoitred properly. We didn't have forward patrols go on, you know, the way they stealthily go through and find out what he is. Things like, we'd had no really preparation. I think there was only about 24 artillery, probably the 149 field battery, 25 pounders, and they were blasting away. As a matter of fact, we captured a senior German officer, and Major Woods had him brought in, and he said, before you take me back to the prison war, he spoke pretty good English, he says, can I see your automatic artillery piece? He says, because I've never heard anything like it. And they say, is this automatic artillery piece? He says, oh, I think I know what you mean. And he just took him back and showed him how 25 pounders in action. And it sounded to the Germans as though it was an automatic artillery gun firing, because they were bang, 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 you know, four guns off and then four guns off, all 12 guns, one after another. When the 25 pounders laid down a stunk, they really threw some stuff over. When they had a real good target to fire at. And they were always kept very close behind us.
Were there other weapons in the British Army which you admired?
Well, in the desert we thought our tanks were rubbish, right up until we saw the General Grant's and the bigger tanks that we were given. Before that, the 2-pounder guns that were up on our Matilda tanks, the Matilda armour, well, our armour piece and rifle bullets were piercing, never mind about the armour piece and tank shell. I think the British Army were very poorly supplied in the first few years, but when we started getting the heavy stuff, mostly American-built stuff, then our armour was really more powerful. Because let's face it, the German Mark IV tank, and then later on the Tiger Mark V, they were really good tanks. Their 88mm gun could be used as either as an artillery piece or an anti-aircraft gun. It was something out of the world. And a squadron of them advancing, well, there's nothing much could stop them.
Were there other German weapons that you particularly respected?
In Sicily, we first heard what we found later to be called the Nebelwerfer. We knew there were mortar shells, but we'd heard our 3-inch mortars putting a stong down, and they were very good, our mortar, the town, at putting stongs down within 1,000 yards or so. But this seemed to be coming from a lot further than 1,000 yards, and when I first heard it, it sounded like a donkey. Hee-haw, hee-haw. Make the noise, and then all these mortars would come over, whistling, and land around about 24, I think, from this Nebelwerfer. I'm not sure how many, probably only about 12, but that was their new mortar gun that they'd invented. It apparently was on a spindle with the and loaded up and just fired off as a multi mortar. And that was a nasty one. But their Spandau machine gun, well, far superior to our Bren gun or any of our heavier machine guns. The Spandau was a light automatic that could send round after round and round, spitting and spewing around. And you could always tell the spat of a Spandau gun. When you heard them, you had to cringe down. You know, if one of their bus came your way, you would have it. And believe you know me, I've squatted down low on the one's belly someday trying to get out of the road.